there were tools available that anyone could use, no one left out. It was a completely inclusive vision of life where anyone was said to have the capacity to change their own minds. Not to change the circumstance they found themselves in, but in terms of the degree of connection or isolation, compassion or bitterness with which it was held. And so I heard that, and there was an independent study program at the school where you could go anywhere theoretically for a year and do any project that they approved of and then come back and do a kind of cross-cultural study. So I said, I want to go to India and study meditation. I wasn't, frankly, interested in Buddhism as a philosophy or an identity. I didn't want to call myself something different. I didn't want to adopt a set of beliefs or a dogma. But if there were some tools that actually could ease the way I saw life and the way I lived life, I wanted them. So off I went. And in fact, I did find it took a little while, but I found the kind of circumstance I was looking for, which wasn't heavily laden with history, culture, beliefs, cosmology, but really centered on almost like an immersion into utilizing those skills of the mind. So from that experience and what's happened from then on, I really do consider meditation practice as a kind of skills training that anybody, if they are interested in, can pursue. It's like an experiment. It's a quality of exploration. So first of all, it's a training in concentration, whereas most of us would probably describe ourselves, perhaps not in every arena of life, but at least in some, as somewhat scattered or distracted, where we sit down to think something through, we're trying to work through a dilemma, we're in conversation with somebody, and it's not that long before our attention goes to the past, and we go over and over and over some situation which perhaps we now feel regretful of but cannot change, or our minds go to the future and we create a scenario that has not happened and may never happen, and perhaps it's laced with a lot of anxiety. I've been using this example lately. I was teaching with a friend of mine, Bob Thurman, who's a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University. So I was teaching with him in New York City, and I just used this as an example, kind of spontaneously. I said, it's like you're sitting in an airplane in New York on the tarmac, and you realize that plane's going to be late. And then begins that anxious cascade toward creating a future. Oh, no, I'll probably miss my connecting flight. Surely I'll miss my connecting flight. What am I going to do? I'm going to land in Portland, Oregon. It's going to be after midnight. Oh, no, there won't be any cabs. It's not New York. What's going to happen? As though Portland had a history of people just perishing after midnight when they landed at the airport, like just disappeared. And I just used that as an example, and also said as a side note that when I see my mind beginning to go in that kind of direction, I have almost a kind of personal mantra, which I say, which is something will happen, right? Like something will happen. So anyway, I said the thing about Bob in the beginning because I just had used that example in front of him. And maybe 6 weeks later, I got an email from him which said, oh, just landed in Portland. Lots of cabs. Because clearly it was a creation of my mind. You know, so our attention can be kind of flickering, going to the past, going to the future, judgment, speculation. It may not have a sense of steadiness, steadfastness, centeredness. And the larger manifestation of that in life tends to be a feeling of fragmentation, the way we can have so much compartmentalization, so much role identification, the way people say, I feel like one person at work and a different person at home. Or my favorite example of this, actually, I was teaching in New York City, and someone raised her hand, and she said, I feel filled with loving kindness and compassion for all beings as long as I'm alone. But once I'm with others, it's really rough. Or maybe we feel quite connected and okay when we're with others, but very ill at ease being alone. And so our lives here, too, can be quite fragmented. So in the process of deepening concentration, we bring that attention together. We bring our energy together so that we do have a sense of being more grounded, of having a center. It's often a very simple process and not exactly what we think. Sometimes we just choose an object. It could be really any object, and whole varieties and systems of meditation practice choose different objects, an image, a visualization, a phrase, a word, a sound. In the school in which I was mostly trained, we tend to choose the feeling of the breath, the actual sensations of the breath as that object. So we have an object, we settle our attention on it, attention goes flying all over the place, we bring it back. So it's a process of learning in that moment to relinquish whatever has distracted us, being gentle, not condemning ourselves or berating ourselves, being able to start over, just bringing our attention back to that object. And one reason they say that the breath is so often chosen as what we call the primary object of meditation, of concentration meditation, is because, first of all, you don't have to believe anything in order to feel your breath. You don't have to declare an allegiance to any system or reject anything else. If you're breathing, you can be meditating. And then, as one of my teachers said, I've always felt quite charmingly, he said, the breath is very portable. If we can practice, say, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes a day in a formal, dedicated way, we can practice at work. No one needs to know you're doing it. It's not like perhaps a meeting here gets contentious. I don't know. But I often use that example. Say you're at a contentious meeting at work, and tempers are starting to go up. You don't have to say, oh, excuse me a minute, and open a closet door and pull out a lot of equipment and sit in a certain posture and look funny. No one even needs to know you're doing it. So it's like a resource that we can touch, we can return to. The breath is very portable, so we can access that sense of groundedness and centeredness wherever we are, as long as we're breathing. So we settle our attention on that object, and we say, interestingly enough, this isn't a process of accumulation. I mean, it's one of the things that's hard about meditation practice, it's difficult for us, is that the results may not be so easily measured with the kind of metric that we're accustomed to. You know, it's nicer for us to be able to say, well, yesterday I could be with 3 breaths before my attention started to wander, so today I can be with 15, and tomorrow I can be with 35, but it's not exactly like that. Progress is much more measured in that moment when we realize we've been distracted. Maybe it's still only 3 breaths later, but we can let go more easily. We can return more readily. We have a greater kindness toward ourselves. These things are harder to measure, but that's the whole transformative nature, is that we bring that into our lives. We have an ability to start over more easily when we lose sight of our aspiration, when we've made a mistake, when we have strayed from our chosen course. We have that resource of coming back to the moment and having that feeling of renewal. So that's the process of deepening concentration. It's said to be very empowering because that's a lot of energy that's flying all over the place that's not available to us, that could be available to us. And it's said to be quite healing because it's a movement toward integration of our being. It's like weaving all those disparate aspects together so that we do have that sense of wholeness. So that's concentration, which is the first skill. And the second is mindfulness, which is, of course, a word that's being used a lot because there's so much research going on about mindfulness. Classically in meditation schools, mindfulness means a quality of awareness where we can be with what's happening, we can connect to our experience in the moment without the intrusion of so much bias, old fears, projection into the future, like what's this going to feel like tomorrow, what's it going to feel like next year, things we feel we're not allowed to feel, that we try to cut off, or a tendency to be completely submerged in the cascade of changing states, not having a sense of spaciousness or perspective. There are lots of ways that we are just habituated to hold on, to push away, to go to sleep, to numb out, to ignore, to distance ourselves too much, to get too lost in and overcome by the various states that come and go. So mindfulness implies a certain balanced relationship to what's happening, not cold and icy, distant, in that maybe mistaken sense that we sometimes use the word balance, but a real sense of honesty and clarity and interest in our experience. So here's my favorite definition of mindfulness these days, which comes from an article in the New York Times now almost 3 years ago, I think. There was a pilot project in the schools in California somewhere, in a fifth grade classroom, bringing the tools of mindfulness to the kids. And it was a great article altogether, but there were two lines in it I especially liked. The first, from one of the researchers, said, "All day long we tell kids to pay attention, but we never teach them how." And then the second was from one of the kids. So I guess fifth grade is like 10 years old, something like that. So they said to him, "What is mindfulness? What is mindfulness?" And he said in response, "Mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth." And I thought, great definition of mindfulness. Mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. Because what does that imply? It implies knowing what we're feeling when it begins, when that feeling begins, not 15 consequential actions later, not after we've gone to our, you know, computer and typed out the email and pressed send. It implies being very in touch and aware of what is happening within and without. It also implies a certain balanced relationship to that emotion, because clearly if we get consumed by, submerged by, overcome by all these changing states, we'll probably hit a lot of people in the mouth. But at the same time, if we hate it, we fear it, we cannot bear that we're having this emotion arise, we're just going to clamp down in some way, and then we're going to explode. It's not going to work. So to be in touch, to know what we're feeling very quickly, to have that sense of balance, which can recognize what's happening, also gives us some space. It gives us some options. Because at that moment, we have time for some wise reflection. Maybe we think, well, you know, last week I hit someone in the mouth. Didn't work out that well. Let me try this instead. It doesn't mean we never respond, we never do anything. And that's one of the great problems, I think, with the word mindfulness, is that it's starting to imply a sort of passivity or complacency, like, I'll just be with whatever. Fine. It's all fine. Which it doesn't really mean at all. It has much more of a sense of a very dynamic kind of choice, because there's space. And we realize we have options. So here's another way to describe it. I went with a friend of mine to a prison in Wisconsin because she'd been teaching meditation there, and I was there to teach for the day. So the fact that it was a prison doesn't really have anything to do with the story, but that's where it took place. So we're in this room, and my friend asked for three people to leave the room. And since that was a prison, that meant a staff person had to go too. So there was four people left the room. And then she asked everyone left, all of us left, to just create a structure in the middle of the room with any material we found. So there were a bunch of chairs, and these guys got up and they piled all these chairs on top of one another. And there were some flags, because it was a state facility, so they put in these flags. And we'd taken off our shoes, so we had a bunch of shoes to pile around the chairs. And I think there was one plant, so they stuck that there. And I looked at this mound of stuff there, and clearly because of the flags, it began evoking all these feelings in me. I thought, oh, this is a monument. And it tells a story of valor and tragedy and challenge and triumph and glory. And then one by one, she asked the people who'd left the room to come in, and she'd say, tell me what you see. So the first person who came back in the room said, I see a monument. And I thought, right on. What a discerning guy. I mean, clearly he has it right. And every person who came into the room told a very different story about what they saw. One person who happened to be the staff person said, I see chaos. I just see chaos. And that's not to say that every story we tell about what we see, what we hear, what we feel, what we sense is accurate. Some are quite distorted. Some are much more realistic. And it's not to say that we are trying to abolish that tendency to tell that story, but mindfulness allows us to see this is what is actually in front of me, and this is the narrative that I am beginning to weave about it. Some stories are fantastic. They bring us together. They raise our aspiration. They open doors for us of what might be possible. Some are very, very damaging. Very old and quite damaging. So here's a story like that. I went to a house once. A friend of ours had rented a house for a number of friends to do a retreat in. And when I went into the bedroom that had been set aside for me, I saw that there was a cartoon that had been left on the desk from the Peanuts comic strip. In the first frame of the cartoon, Lucy's talking to Charlie Brown, and she says, you know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is, the problem with you is that you're you. Then in the second frame of the cartoon, poor Charlie Brown looks at her and says, well, what in the world can I do about that? Then in the third and final frame, Lucy says, I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem. And somehow, whenever I was walking by that desk, my eye would fall right on that line. The problem with you is that you're you, because that Lucy dominant voice had been so strong in my earlier life. Something really great happened. Well, it's never going to happen again. Or do you really deserve to be happy? Or if you make a mistake, that's not the opportunity to begin again. That's the opportunity for a very big downward spiral for a very long time. That's a kind of story. If you really knew who you were, or you don't have the capacity to change, or whatever it might be. So what mindfulness does, going back to the prison for a second, mindfulness allows us just to make that distinction, not to annihilate the capacity for the story, not to cease to respond to anything in life, but it brings a kind of awareness, certainly, and intelligence to those moments, because we see, look what I am weaving. And what is it? We have the possibility of some great discernment right there. And do we want to continue in that vein? Do we want to let it go? And we can let it go because we've trained in that. So that's mindfulness, to be able to be so in touch with our experience that we can see really into the nature of it. And once we can do that, then we can look much more deeply into whatever is happening. We see layers and layers and layers that might have been disguised or hidden when we were just struggling against what's going on or so completely caught up in it. If we're looking at an emotion, it may be anger we're looking at. We may see layers of sadness and fear and a sense of powerlessness or helplessness. If we're looking at a time of great delight and joy, we may see levels of withholding and ways that we're not experiencing perhaps as fully as we might what's going on. We may look at our attention and notice that We have a tendency to fixate on what we don't have rather than on what we do have. Just so many things that are very interesting that we might never notice just in a superficial movement through a day. So mindfulness really opens us to seeing so much and understanding so much more, including truths about change, renewal, possibility, the fragility of life, the tentativeness of all situations, including a truth of interconnection, that when we look quite deeply at any experience, we see layers and layers and layers. So, for example, if each of you just reflected right now for a few moments on the different people, encounters, conversations that have led you to be listening to this right now, this talk right now. So I'll assume nobody was like walking through with their lunch and just thought they'd sit down. That we're here, each of us, because of a confluence of conditions and connections and relationships and all kinds of things. That's what this moment in time is. That's what every moment in time is this confluence. So sometimes I do this reflection and I think back to being in college. I think back to the Board of Regents of the state of New York who gave me a scholarship so I could go to college, so I could go to India. That's a part of why I'm here right now. So many things. This is what we see, that life is more intricate, connected, than might appear on the surface. The Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh has this exercise where he like holds up a string bean or something like that, and he says, now see the universe, because you can. Or we look at a tree and we see not just the entity of the tree standing there as a seemingly singular, solid thing. We also sense the nature of the soil, which is nurturing it, and everything that affects that soil, and the rainfall, and everything that affects the rainfall, and the quality of the air, and the sunlight, and the moonlight. That's also the tree. It's a network. Everything is. This is part of the insight that comes just naturally from paying attention in a deeper way, not in a feigned or a forced or contrived way, but because this is what we actually see. So then the third skill of meditation after greater concentration and greater mindfulness is greater loving kindness and compassion. And to go back to prison yet one more time, if mindfulness allows us to see the distinction between our experience and the story that is coming about, loving kindness, or the deepening of loving kindness and compassion, changes our default story. That ready, immediate narrative that tends to rush in doesn't have to be Lucy, in fact. It can be, instead of a story of fear, a story about connection, a story about inclusion rather than exclusion. And this is based on that kind of wisdom of seeing interconnection. So loving kindness literally means friendship. It doesn't mean we like everybody or approve of everybody, but the construct of self and other with a great big other out there, the construct of being in or being out, of there being a line that divides us, the construct of us and them, are seen as constructs. And we understand that we have an alternative vision of life which is actually more true. So this is actually a skill to pay attention in a different way. And all of the heart spaces, you could say, that are evoked from a different quality of attention. And I find this interesting because I've been present a fair number of times when different neuroscientists and researchers have been presenting their findings, say to the Dalai Lama, about meditation studies. And whereas early studies were pretty exclusively focused on mindfulness as a skill, more and more people are studying compassion meditation in these different settings. So very often I've been present as these findings have been reported, and almost always the researcher will conclude with a statement like, and from this, one can almost begin to think that compassion can be seen as a skill. And it's always this sort of pronouncement, like, woo, this is a big deal. And I always think, oh, right, you know. Because from the point of view of meditation training, obviously it's a skill. I mean, there's no question of that. And I look at that, too. I'm quite intrigued by that, why it can seem so often that that's worthy of a pronouncement. Do we tend to think of compassion more as a gift, and some people have it and others don't, and if you don't, you're out of luck, or just a kind of immediate emotional response not based in anything, based in a worldview, based in how we see ourselves or others? But from the point of view of meditation, compassion is absolutely a skill, because it's all generated by how we pay attention. So if concentration training steadies our attention and mindfulness training refines our attention, so it's not so cluttered by all this other stuff, compassion training or loving kindness training opens our attention. It really has a stretch in different ways. So if there are people, for example, you tend to ignore, look right through, discount, disregard, the question becomes, what happens when you actually pay attention to them? It's not the phony forcing of a certain kind of emotion, like I'm going to like you or something like that. But it is the willingness to shift, to move out of a rut, to open and expand who we pay attention to. And then we see what happens from that. Or what do we pay attention to? Do we pay attention nearly exclusively and most obsessively to what we don't like about somebody? Can we actually open to have a more inclusive and total perspective about somebody? This doesn't feel right often. It feels kind of weird, but it's an interesting experiment to make, just to move out of that rut, whatever it might be. Or how about if in conversation our attention tends to be quite fragmented? We barely pay attention to people because people are distracting us from the next 50 emails we need to send and everything else we need to do. And so they're talking and we're gone. So what happens when we gather our attention and we actually arrive and we listen? So the training in deepening loving kindness and compassion is really this tremendous experiment in attention. Sometimes people think of it as something that will force them to try to pretend to feel something. It is seen as very gooey or sentimental and not that appealing. I teach an intensive loving kindness meditation retreat at the center I co-founded, the Insight Meditation Society, every year. And at the beginning of one retreat, this guy came, and I don't actually know why he was there. He must have been there to make someone else happy. He said to me at the beginning of the retreat, I hate this meditation because it reminds me of a continually enforced Valentine's Day. Like on the count of three, you will be filled with love. You know, something coercive and very strange. But I'm happy to say by the end of the retreat, he was reporting a very different experience, because it's not that. the training in loving kindness or compassion is absolutely an attention training and seeing what happens with the consequences of that. So here's another example. I was also teaching with Bob Thurman somewhere, and he used this example. He said, imagine you're on a subway and these Martians come and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are in the subway car are going to be together forever. He says, what do you do? If someone's hungry, you feed them. If somebody's freaking out, you try to calm them down. Not because you necessarily like them, but because your lives have something to do with one another. You're going to be together forever. So I loved that example, and I started using it quite a bit. And then one day, I was sitting on an airplane in a tarmac in New York City, and I was flying to Tucson, and the plane ended up sitting on the runway for 4.5 hours in what, looking back, I sometimes now refer to as the breakdown of civilization, because it got hotter and hotter and hotter, and people were yelling and screaming and getting madder and madder. And at one point, the pilot sort of took command of the aircraft. He got on the PA system, and he said, no one is leaving this aircraft. And I wasn't feeling that chipper myself. You know, I was thinking, I'm paying rent in New York City. You know, like, if they let me off the airplane, I could go back to my apartment. And then I could try again tomorrow. No reason not to. But I couldn't get off the plane. And then just sitting there, all of a sudden, that image that Bob had used came up in my mind. Imagine you're on a subway, and these Martians come, and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are there are going to be together forever. And I looked around the airplane, and I thought, maybe these are my people. And it was quite interesting, because things shifted. I realized that some amount of my own ire was the thought, how long am I going to be stuck with these people? And then I thought, forever. Like, deal. It's a different imperative to deal. That's a kind of movement of the mind to say, okay, here's a certain rut, here's a certain familiar realm of attention. What happens when I include rather than exclude? What happens when I think this may not come to an end? These people have something to do with me in the end. So we play with our attention quite a lot in this training. So these three skills are really the essence of meditation. I think whatever form it might take, and there are many, many, many methods, it's really up to us if we want to experiment and to continue to deepen these skills. The hardest thing about meditation practice is that it needs to be done, not just thought about. It would be so much easier if we could just admire it from afar and get all the benefit, but it's not like that. It's very empirical. It's very real. And so I think it's worth the experiment, if you want, to see what kind of methodology might best suit you and what conditions might help you actually do some. So do you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about? We might have a chance to practice for a few minutes as well. Yeah, I think, do I have to give him the microphone?
Okay. How do you keep from falling asleep while meditating?
You might fall asleep while meditating. It's not uncommon. Sometimes what we discover is that we're very, very, very tired, and it's only when we stop that we see that level of fatigue. So it's not always a bad thing to see. Sometimes it's very instructive. We also set the stage for trying not to fall into the sleepiness and have it be so overwhelming. Sometimes you sit with your eyes open. You might choose to do a walking meditation, say, instead of a sitting meditation. One of the big things in attention training is having a sense of immediacy. So if, say, you're using a technique like being with the breath, if you have the thought, well, I'll just be aware of this breath in the next 50, you're going to go to sleep. But if you say, just one breath, just one, just now, it'll give you some energy. Things like that. So we work with the attention to be somewhat more gathered and more precise. Okay. The question was about the opposite situation, where it was a great image, actually. She said, it's like 50,000 people trying to get out of a stadium all at the same time. Well, it's like sitting down, and like the doors are opening, 50,000 thoughts are just spilling out. So it feels like a waste of time, and then it's very discouraging, so she just gives up. You are not failing at meditation, I promise you. Really, and I don't say that just to be comforting or to offer some solace. You're not failing at meditation, because meditation practice is not, in the end, it's not about what's happening. It's about how we're relating to what's happening. And that also makes it difficult to measure. You know, it would be easier to say, well, I had a good session because there were no thoughts. But that may not be true. You might have a billion thoughts and all nasty thoughts, too, to boot. But you might be relating to them with some awareness and balance, and that would be considered a very good meditation. So really, you cannot fail at it. But it's important to understand what the goal actually is. Also, those states don't last forever. You know, they're just times of some greater uproar or agitation, maybe, and so there's this great outpouring of thoughts. So also, if you just sat there a little longer, it would quiet down. So please don't take it personally and don't feel that you failed. So we do two different things in the face of that kind of restless thinking. One is to see if you could have it be a little more in the distance and take a little more interest in the feeling of your breath, if that's the object that you're centering your attention on. The example is sometimes used of seeing a friend in a crowd. You don't have to shove aside everyone else and say, go away, you're bothering me, you're in the way. But your interest, your enthusiasm is going, oh, there's my friend. There's the breath. There's the breath. Everything else can come and go, come and go, come, doesn't matter. There's the breath. So if you can find that kind of balance, you'll find some ease, even though the thoughts are still churning. And sometimes what we do is almost the opposite of that, which is you sit down and you make the wild movement of thoughts the object of your attention. It's like you're in a storm. Well, like, you know, I came in yesterday to this area and it was raining and raining and raining. And then the person who was driving me said, well, you know, it's going to snow tomorrow. I thought, oh, great, you know. I was just in Seattle where it snowed for the first time in like 100 years or something like that, you know. But weather's weather, right? And so sometimes you just think this is an inner storm and I'm just going to open and let it process through instead of try to control it and constrain it, which isn't going to work. So that's another thing to do. Yeah. Yeah. Walking meditation is also done. The question was, how does one do walking meditation? It's also done in a variety of different ways. Some schools of meditation would say, first of all, eyes open. That's very important. Some schools would say, as you are walking, see if you can still maintain a light awareness of the feeling of your breath. even as you're walking along. The way I was trained didn't do that so much. The object of attention shifted more to the actual sensations of your body and movement, your feet touching the ground, things like that. So the first thing I usually suggest is eyes open, and then see if you can bring your energy down so you feel your feet from your feet, not as though who you were, your consciousness was residing up here in your head somewhere, trying to peer down, see what's going on, but feel your feet from your feet. I wrote, when I was writing a description of walking meditation in this book I just wrote, the editor put in a line saying something like, it's like your feet are looking back at you. And I thought, that's so weird. Like, I didn't say that, you know? And then I tried it, and I thought, ooh, it is kind of like that. That's what it feels like. And you just feel the simple sensations. It's not an anatomical exercise where you're trying to think, oh, this muscle group's doing this and that muscle group's doing that. You just actually feel heaviness, lightness, pressure, hardness, softness. You don't name them, but you feel them. So it's a very light attention because you don't want to hunker down and cut off awareness of everything around you. But it's a really fascinating exercise because it keeps us aware in a time that, obviously, if we're in transition, we're usually thinking about the next place we're going and everything we need to do and so on. So it actually opens up that transition time as a time of more mindfulness. Yeah. So the question was, she finds chanting to be easier, and does that count as meditation? Yes, I think it counts as meditation. My personal bias, and it's a beautiful, extraordinary experience to do chanting. My personal bias in meditation is that I would like everyone to have at least some baseline technique that they can use anywhere. And then whatever else we do for the sake of the experience or the training is a wonderful addition, but we've got that kind of nitty-gritty thing that goes with us anywhere. Because if you are in some difficult or challenging or anxiety-producing state, I mean, maybe you could chant inside, but it wouldn't necessarily be that easy. But you can breathe. So, yeah. Is it possible to combine meditation and prayer? I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think if one has that orientation, then certainly. And I think that would be I think it's always a good addition to know what we actually want, to know what's happening within, to know what our motivation is, to know what's cooking, to know what's taking us away and how to come back to what we're doing. Yeah. Yeah. How does one introduce mindfulness to children? Interestingly enough, there was an article in the LA Times just a month or so ago, which someone had done a meta-analysis of all these different studies about mindfulness, and they came to the conclusion, according to the article, that yes, there really is scientific validation for mindfulness and the kinds of changes it provides in attention and so on. But then the person later on in the article said something like, well, of course we know it couldn't work for children, and it couldn't work for elderly people who are very set in their ways, and it couldn't work for people without very sharp intelligence, and all these people, it was like this uproar, like, wait a minute. You know, I know lots of older people and children and maybe not totally brilliant people too who are doing mindfulness with great effect. So there are several books now that are really good books about mindfulness training for children according to the developmental stage. Susan Kaiser Greenland is one author. This book, The Mindful Child. Linda Lantieri wrote a book that's used a lot in New York City as well. Basically, we just take the same techniques and make them concrete. I've taught loving kindness meditation to children trying to make it very concrete. You know, think about someone at school. Think about when you feel safe. Is it when you're holding someone's hand? Is it doing this or whatever? And then mindfulness can be great fun depending on the age of the child. Feel, lie down, feel your belly moving up and down. Put a stuffed animal on your belly, watch them go up and down, things like that. So Susan Kaiser Greenland and then Linda Lantieri.
So what you were saying about not sort of standing in judgment over your success in meditation reminds me of a story of something that happened here at the local Zen Center in Mountain View. Mm-hmm. There was a sesshin, or meditation retreat, going on. And one of the participants was having a very hard time. He was uncomfortable and sort of fidgety, and his mind was racing and everything. And after a few hours of this, he went to a Dokusan interview with the Roshi and said, I think I'm going to just leave because I'm just having a terrible sitting here. I can't settle down. And the Roshi listened to all this for a while, and then he just smiled kindly and shook his head, and he said, go back in. There's no such thing as a bad sitting. And so he did that and sat down, and things seemed to get a lot better. And at the end of the day, he came back to the Roshi, and he said, thank you so much for making me stay. He said, it was really great, and for the rest of the day, I had a really good sitting. And the Roshi smiled kindly and shook his head and said, there's no such thing as a good sitting.
That's fabulous. That's a great story. Thank you. Well, I went to one of my teachers early on when I was living in India, because I wasn't always on intensive retreat. I was trying to have a life, and it was a very simple life in those days. This was the 70s in India, no job, no family, no phones, no computer, no faxes, no email. But still, it was quite difficult to have a regular practice, and as it is. And it was difficult in large part, I think, because I was judging my practice all the time. When I sat down to meditate and it felt peaceful and serene, I think, oh, good, I'm going to live the entire rest of my life in India doing just this. And when it was difficult or challenging or I hurt or I was bored or I was sleepy, I'd get up and I think it's not working. And so finally I went to one of my teachers and described this pattern, and he said to me, for you, I have just one piece of advice, and that is just put your body there. He said, every day, just put your body there. It's not that there's never a time for evaluation and assessment, because there is, but not every moment that you're doing it. And the real fruit or the consequence of the practice is usually not in your, it's not seen in your formal sitting. And it's a good thing, because we don't practice meditation to become a great meditator. We practice meditation because of the effect in our lives of these qualities of mindfulness, of concentration, of greater compassion, and so on. So it may not even be while you're sitting that you notice that it's done anything. But you will notice when you're in conversation with somebody, or when you do make a mistake, or when you kind of open up your sense of aspiration to be bigger and not be so limited by forces of habit and things like that. And that's where it counts. So it's a good thing. It's an interesting question. The question was, is it harder for someone, say, a newspaper reporter who is bearing witness, in effect, to great atrocity and trauma, to do something like loving-kindness meditation because of the disparity between the reality of what people are going through and this sort of ideal of compassion or loving-kindness? I think that, you know, many people are experiencing a lot of trauma and seeing a lot. And some of the more interesting and newer studies are trying to bring meditation practice to those situations to see what kind of effect it might have. And I think that, is it harder? I think it is. Sometimes it's harder, sometimes it's not. In terms of loving kindness practice, because almost always one sees people who are responding in the most horrible of situations from a basis of compassion. And you think, how can that be, you know, that people find that in that terrible, desperate, awful situation? And yet they do. And so I think we bear witness to that as well, which seems to be a capacity of the human heart. And also, for some people, there's a certain sense that the kind of dualism and exclusion and discounting and creation of the other is at the root of so much of the devastation that happens, that we've got to find another way. It's just, we're compelled. And a lot of that depends on one's understanding of loving kindness or compassion. If it seems too sweet and nice, you know, and fluffy, it's not going to serve as that alternative. But if we understand a certain power in seeing the world differently, then it could serve. It's like, I don't remember accurately the famous quotation from Albert Einstein where he said something like, the significant problems that we face cannot be solved by the same level of thinking that created them. Something like that. And so that's the kind of experiment we make. It's like, whoa, we need a very different way of thinking. And so let's look at what happens with this. So. Okay. Thank you all so much. May you be happy.